It is my pleasure to introduce to you Lila Rose, President and Founder of Live Action. Her topic is Exposing Planned Parenthood Abortion Mills.
Thank you, Molly, and the organizers of this wonderful event. Is everyone having a wonderful time coming together around such a wonderful, wonderful cause? There's really no greater cause than this beautiful cause for life, that we all get to come here tonight to celebrate, to remember, and also to resolve, to be resolved together, to do whatever we can to make this a country that respects and protects every human life, especially the weakest, especially the smallest. I was recently graduated in the last couple years from UCLA. Any Californians in the room? Perhaps, just a couple. All right, expatriates to the cold of the Cleveland over here. But I was giving a talk actually in LA a few years back, and it was at a church. And I was a student kind of juggling my history classes and then juggling my pro-life classes, which of course I didn't have. It was my pro-life activism, and I definitely preferred the latter. And so I would, you know, try to scrape by getting good enough grades, but at the same time really devoted to a lot of pro-life work in college. And I'm so grateful now to be out of school, getting to do this wonderful work full-time. But I was giving this talk at this church. And it was, of course, on pro-life and, on the abortion industry, on what we're facing, on the dignity of the human person. And in the middle of my talk, it's a beautiful day in Beverly Hills. In the middle of my talk, this woman walks in, and she's leaning on the back of the wall in the parish hall. And she's looking at me very sternly, you know, with this frown on her face. And she has long blonde hair. She's, you know, holding a small dog. She looks like she just got off the set of Legally Blonde or something. And that's, of course, very typical for the LA area. And so I'm like, oh, maybe she had a bad day. You know, maybe she got stuck in traffic. You know, who knows? So after my talk, this woman comes up to me and she shakes my hand and she introduces herself as a member of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America's board, their board of directors. And I said, well, hello, you know, nice to see you, you know, nice to meet you. I fancy seeing you here at church, you know, good to see you here at church. You know, you should come more often. I didn't say that. I just said, nice to see you here. You know, good to see you here. I said, you know, how are you? I wasn't sure what she wanted from me, but I was certainly interested in talking with her. And she said, young lady, she said, I heard that you would be talking. I saw a flyer and I thought that I had to come by to your talk to give you some advice as a mom. Funny that she would say as a mom when she's advocating for the very violence that denies mothers their motherhood. And so I said to her, well, what would that advice be? What would you have to say? And she said, well, listen, in your speeches and in the media, you have to stop saying pro-abortion. You have to say pro-choice. And I thought, you know, she came all the way here to tell me this. I was like, is this like media training from Planned Parenthood? They're pretty good at PR. But I said, so why? I said to her, why? What's so wrong with being pro-abortion? What's so wrong with the phrase pro-abortion? What's so wrong with abortion? And she was a little uncomfortable. And she said, well, you know, it's just a very offensive term. Okay. That's why it's offensive to me. And I said, well, why? Why is the phrase pro-abortion, why is to be for abortion so offensive? What is so offensive about abortion? And she didn't really answer the question. And she just said, well, you know, abortion is a very difficult decision, Lila. So it's not to be taken lightly. And I said, well, why? Why is abortion such a difficult decision? What makes abortion so difficult? And she said, well, it's personal to a woman and it's hard. And we kept going back in circles and I would say, you know, why is it so offensive? Why is it so difficult? Why is it so hard? Why are you uncomfortable with the phrase pro-abortion? What's so uncomfortable about abortion? And a small crowd started to gather in the hall and we kept going back and forth. And I quickly realized that this board member of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America would not be able to answer my question, what's so wrong with abortion? For if she did, she would be looking head on her whole life's work contradiction. Because she said she got involved with Planned Parenthood as a young woman in her 20s. She's now in her 50s, working as a sex educator. And she would look full on her life's work contradiction, that while advocating for women and for the rights of women as she thought, and for reproductive freedom and for justice and for choice, and all these magnanimous, these wonderful altruistic ideas that she thought that she had, she was really advocating for the killing of millions of tiny little women in the womb across the world every year, and millions of tiny little men. I pray for this woman and the many others like her, many who are just so blind to the horror that they are fighting for. And I pray that one day she'll allow the reality of it to touch her heart, to break her heart, and then she can join our side, which after all is the winning side, which is the side of life, the best side to be on. I first had my first encounter with abortion when I was a young girl. I'm so blessed to be from a big family. I'm one of eight kids. Any big families out there? A few of us. any families with, four kids and more? Right, any hands up? Okay. We've got a small village in here. What about five and more? Keep those hands up, okay? Bigger village, six and more kids? This is in your family or you have them. Either way, you get to take responsibility. Seven or more? Okay. Keep the hands up. Eight or more kids? That's rivaling my family. What about nine? We still have quite a few hands. 10? Okay. We dropped a little bit. 11? We are still going strong, a few of you. 12? Any 12? You deserve a hand. Now, are those your kids? Your mom, okay, she deserves a hand. How beautiful. Well, I'm one of eight kids, and my mom does lament that she didn't have more. She's like, just two more twin girls, because there's five boys and there's three girls. And I was raised between the five boys, and I prayed for 9 years for a sister because I had only brothers. And finally God gave, answered my prayer by giving my mom another baby, which I was so grateful for. But we were raised with the conviction that many of you in here, I think, share and even had growing up, which was that life was such a gift. And that the child was such a gift. And that, the baby coming into the family was such a surprise and such a delight. And there was this real conviction in my family that every human life, no matter the difficulties that we may have struggled with, my dad and mom had plenty of struggles. They did not know what they were getting themselves into, I think. And they often, joke now that they said that. But it was a great, wonderful mess, as they have said. And we were also taught, to respect the elderly, and we were raised with Christian principles in that, life is precious because of God within us, because we're made in the image and likeness of a God who loves us, of a Father who loves us, and then this idea of a Jesus Christ who came to earth to save all of the world. And these things were, taught to me, but they weren't necessarily involved in pro-life activism. I think they were doing plenty of pro-life activism trying to raise a family of eight. But they weren't really necessarily involved, so I didn't really have an idea of a pro-life movement, or certainly not of abortion. I mean, what I really heard about abortion was, in murmured tones at the dinner table, words about Bill Clinton, like it was a bad word or something, or the Clintons, and partial birth abortion back in the 90s. And I would think, oh, this must be really bad. And so, I'd always perk up at the sound of Clinton. But I didn't really know what abortion meant. I didn't really understand, I didn't really understand what this was all about. But when I was 9 years old, I was looking for a book to read. It was sort of one of those rare rainy days in Northern California. Usually it's beautiful and sunny. And I found a book on the bottom shelf in our living room called A Handbook on Abortion by Dr. and Mrs. Wilkie. And it had a very serious looking woman on the cover, and it was kind of looking a little like black and white, and she had long hair. She looked like it was from the 80s or something. And so I thought, this must be a history book of some kind. So I pulled it out. Not that that was that long ago. For me, it was ancient. So I pull it out and I open up the book, and it falls to the center where it had been creased. And I'm staring at these images. And in shock and horror, I close the book and I push it away. I don't want to keep looking at what I'm looking at. And then gathering up a little bit of 9-year-old courage, I grab the book and I pull it back and I open it up and I look again. And what I was looking at was the image of a tiny child, maybe 10 weeks old, with newly forming little arms and little legs and a newly forming little face, who had been the victim of a first trimester abortion. And as I looked at this translucent skin and the blood where the body parts had been torn off, as I looked at this little vulnerable child in this image, my heart was struck. And I thought, is this real? Is this really happening? And how could anybody do this to a baby? And I went and I found my mom in the kitchen and I showed her the book and I said, is this real? Is this really happening? And she closed the book and she said, yes, and that's abortion. After seeing that image, of course, I had so many questions. I wanted to know why, how, you know, what does it mean? I started to read this book. I learned about how since 1973, this had been somehow a constitutional right. Somehow it was a right. It was the law for this to be okay. And that a woman at any stage in pregnancy in places all over the country could take in her child for what I saw in this image. And I learned that every day there were over 3,000 of these in our country, over 1 million a year. And I learned that within 10 miles of my childhood home where I grew up with my brothers and sisters feeling so safe and loved, there was an abortion clinic, a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic, open for business on Thursdays and Tuesdays and Saturdays, killing 30 children a day, almost 100 children a week. And suddenly I began to realize that even though I was so safe, there were children close to me that were not so safe. And that there were mothers close to me that did not have the support that I knew my mother had. And I began to think, is there something that I can or that I should do? Because I wanted to somehow do something. And as I got a little older, I began to learn about all the other issues that we face as a nation. I mean, I was involved in different extracurricular activities like debate club and speech club and doing different research projects. And I learned, I got to do a missions trip to Housebuild in Mexico. And I began to learn about all these different things in the world, these struggles, you know, foreign relations, AIDS in Africa, poverty, homelessness, you know, the problems with frustrations with the economy. I learned about all these issues. Issues, burning issues that confront themselves politically, socially, personally to us every day. But I kept coming back to the issue, to the image of that little child. Because I thought at the end of the day, if we allow that killing, how can all these other things of course can come, and what else can matter if we're not protecting the littlest one among us? I was reading Mother Teresa's. I started reading Mother Teresa's writings as a young teen. And one thing that she said, whenever she had the opportunity, this little humble nun from Calcutta would say very strong things about abortion, even though she was, you know, working with the lepers and the lonely and the dying. But whenever she had the opportunity, she would say very strong things about the unborn child. And at the National Prayer Breakfast in 1994, in front of, again, the Clintons, this Nobel Peace Prize winner, this expert on peace, directed these words to this assembly of political elites in Washington. And she said, the greatest destroyer of peace in the world today is the cry of the innocent unborn child. And in a nation where a mother can kill her own child, what is left but for you and for I to kill one another? And as I read these words, as a young girl, I wanted to do something with my life. I think we all, of course, especially when we're young, we think, what am I going to do with my life, this life that I've been given? I felt very, very blessed with the life I'd been given, and I wanted my life to be meaningful. I wanted my life to be worth something, because otherwise, what's the point, really? And so I thought, you know, if I want to give my life to something, what better thing than to give it to the most burning cause that confronts me today, this burning cause, this greatest destroyer of peace, as Mother Teresa says. And that's why we're all here tonight, because we all care about the things in our own lives, our families. We care about this country. We care about any number of political, you know, economic, social issues. But we recognize that there is no greater destroyer of peace.
Nothing that tears apart the family turns the woman against herself, the father against himself, the couple against each other, that burns and hurts our nation, the greatest human rights abuse, because laws are meant to protect the weak from the strong. And if the weakest member of society, instead of being protected from their most fundamental rights, is being stripped of their most fundamental, the most fundamental right to life, what good are the rest of the laws if this law system does not recognize and respect the weakest member of the society? We're all here tonight because we recognize the importance of this issue, that this is not just another issue to be collected with a number of other issues, but it is something to give one's life to. It is something to stand up to and respond to the crisis at hand. And surely we are in a great crisis today. We've been in a great crisis ever since we allowed this injustice, but it grows each day as we see all of the other attacks that accompany it. When I got to UCLA as a college freshman, I was so excited to, you know, go to UCLA because I wanted to go to the most pro-life school I could find. That's a joke. UCLA is, you know, 40,000 people in the heart of LA, and it's not very pro-life at all. It's actually one of the more liberal pro, you know, abortion schools in the country. But I chose the school to do pro-life work, and starting Live Action in high school with some friends to do pro-life youth education, wanted to take the educational efforts to UCLA. And I quickly realized what many of the people here may have seen on their campuses, or they've heard their, you know, if you have students or, you know, children at college at certain schools, what they may see on their campuses, which is this radical anti-life in the womb mentality connected to a pro-promiscuity culture that they say maybe the hookup culture. And quickly, being in my first year in the dorms, I knew that there was this hookup culture. There was a lot of my fellow students who were sexually active, a lot of it connected to drugs or alcohol and so much suffering that accompanied that, but that there were girls that were getting pregnant. And I wondered at the fact that there were not a single pregnant student on my campus. I never saw, my 4 years there, I never saw a single student, undergrad or even a graduate student, I saw some faculty that was pregnant. And I thought, how can this be? What does this mean that this school, UCLA, which is all about empowerment, and certainly about women's empowerment and about choice and about fulfilling your dreams, is encouraging with a bowl of condoms on every level of the 5-story tall student health center, big bowls of condoms, the LGBT center, promoting different sexual experimentation. And yet, despite all of that, where is the support for the natural gift, ultimately, of intimacy, but what is meant to be committed, loving intimacy between two people, the gift which is a child? What is the response to that for the students here? And so this led me to do my first journalism project. I thought, okay, what are they telling students that get pregnant at UCLA? And I wanted to, you know, we wanted to launch this magazine, Advocate, as a pro-life student magazine to the student body. And so we thought, well, let's do the feature piece to do an investigation of our health center, the Student Arthur Ashen Wellness Center. And so my first investigation wasn't of a Planned Parenthood clinic. I got my feet wet at my own health center on my own campus in the middle of my own quad. And I was going to pose as myself, very original. It was very easy to do, actually. And I wanted to just go in and say I thought I might be pregnant, flash my student ID, and just see what they would tell me as a college freshman. And so I walked into my health center. I made an appointment with the head nurse, and I sat down with her to discuss my options. She said, okay, you think you're pregnant? I said, yes, I think I'm pregnant. And she told me point blank, UCLA doesn't support women who are pregnant or help them necessarily. But there are two abortion doctors who do abortions that I could refer you to, one at the UCLA Medical Center and one nearby. One does medical and one does surgical. One's out of town for the next week, but he'll be back in 2 weeks. And if you don't want it on your parents' health insurance because you're currently insured under their insurance, you can get the state, we'll find a way to get the state of California to cover this abortion, and they'll never have to know about it. That's fraud, by the way. And when I asked her if there are any other options, she said, well, there's adoption, but that's like giving away a present. And, you know, you could carry the baby to term, but it would be embarrassing. You might have to use the bathroom during class. You might embarrass your fellow students. And there's nothing that we can do to help you. after hearing that, I thought, you know, of course, a school that promotes empowerment and all of these things, and this is the one choice. This is no choice. This is the one choice that I'm given, which is these abortionists are here to help you. And will the state of California pay for it? And I suddenly realized why there are no pregnant students on campus, even though the same health center processes over 2,000 pregnancy tests every year. Some of those may be repeat, but we're talking at least 1,000 girls going in for pregnancy tests into my health center. How many of those girls are getting abortions? And my heart sank to think that I was sitting in class with girls who might be in the very quandary that I was purporting myself to be in, but that quandary of what do I do when UCLA doesn't support me? I don't want anyone to know. I didn't mean to get into this situation. And what do I do? And then there's two abortionists ready and willing to help and leave that girl, that young girl, and so many other young girls and would-be fathers with that mark on their hearts that they'll never forget, and they'll always mourn of the child that they never had. Meanwhile, while groups like Planned Parenthood and even some of the well-meaning faculty at UCLA are saying that their grief has no justification because that was not a baby, and this was a good choice for you to get on with your life. But we all know what a great lie this is and how offensive it is to a woman, to true womanhood. It goes against the very fiber of our being, which is to fight for our families, to fight for the person next to us, to fight for love and to fight for life. And it goes against the fiber of a man to fight for all those things as well. After that first investigation, I was very troubled. I wanted to get it out to as many students as possible. This is not choice. This is anti-choice. This is of course, anti-life. Abortion hurts women. And we started to, you know, send it around campus. And then I got to thinking, you know, if this is what my health center is saying, what is the abortion industry up to? I had done research on them. I had studied them. I had prayed outside of Planned Parenthood clinics before. I had done that, but I wondered, you know, what is going on inside? Because with their slick marketing campaigns about women's empowerment and choice and their new slogan now, which is, we are here for you, particularly targeting certain communities, weak communities, the communities on college campuses and universities, young women, targeting minority groups, Black, Hispanic communities. I thought, is there a way we can expose what I'm sure is happening inside these clinics, which is abuse and manipulation and even coercion and misinformation and all the other abuses that are connected to that ultimate abuse of abortion? Because when you don't respect the life of that child, when you're willing to shred that child to pieces, and there's that great disrespect for the dignity, for the preciousness of that life, should we be so surprised when we see that objectivism of that little child, that turning against that little child, when we see that extended to the woman, when we see that extended to the women walking into these clinics, when they're not cared for either, and instead they're seen as another abortion to add to a quota, another $500 to add to numbers, or another woman to fulfill an ideology which claims that somehow abortion is empowerment, when we know that's a complete lie. And so this inspired me to do my first investigation of a Planned Parenthood clinic, and I want to share the story of how this went. I was 18 again at the time. This was a few months after the investigation of my health center, and I wanted to discover how they would respond to statutory rape cover-up, because I had done some research and I had discovered that, you know, other pro-life organizations who've been involved in the movement long before me have been doing some investigative work long before me, and they had findings out there. I read about them online, and there was a group out of Texas called Life Dynamics, and a great man, Mark Crutcher, and he had done an investigation, and he had found in 2002, through a series of phone calls to over 800 Planned Parenthood clinics, that in 91% of the calls that were made, the actor posing as a 13-year-old girl with a much older boyfriend was told by the Planned Parenthood worker on the other end of the phone that they had a don't ask, don't tell policy about sexual abuse, and that she could come in for an abortion and no questions would be asked, over 91% of the clinics. And I thought, well, first of all, I thought about my little sister, and I thought about, you know, a young girl that I used to mentor, and I thought, you know, this could be anyone's daughter. And how horrific, no matter your position on abortion, who could possibly support that? And how is this possibly pro-empowerment, especially when there are laws in every state in the country that regulate this and say that there is statutory reporting for even suspected, when there's even a small suspicion of child abuse, of child sexual abuse, of statutory rape. And so putting a camcorder in my purse and a voice recorder in my blouse, it wasn't very high tech back then. I just wanted to, you know, borrowed a camcorder from a friend in the dorm. I put on some flip flops. I just, you know, put on an old t-shirt. I was trying to look 15. It wasn't very hard as I was only 18. And I decided to walk into a clinic in Santa Monica, a beautiful part of LA, right on 3rd Street Promenade, which goes up to the ocean. It's like a tourist trap, and there's restaurants and shops, and there's a goes up to the ocean where there's a Ferris wheel. And right above a coffee shop on the second story is a Planned Parenthood medical abortion clinic open for business. I got up to the building, went at the elevator, got off the elevator, stood there looking into this waiting room for this Planned Parenthood clinic. I'd never been inside a clinic before. My friend, you know, I had a friend waiting outside in a car. I was very nervous. My heart was beating very quickly. You could hear my heart beating on the back of the audio track because it's right by my heart, and it's like a soundtrack to the whole thing. And I stopped there looking into this waiting room, and there's all these women sitting there. And some of them looking kind of frustrated or unhappy. One woman looking like she might be about to cry. You know, there's a TV blaring. And I remember thinking as I looked at these women that for some of them who were there for an abortion consultation or a medical abortion or to be sent to the surgical clinic, you know, across town, that for some of these women, I wasn't just looking at one life, but I was looking at two lives. And in that clinic, on that day, the cycle of death or the appointment for death would be begun for one of those women, for some of those women, for that child. And on the wall of the clinic, it said Esperanza in big blue letters. Esperanza, or hope in Spanish. And I thought, this must be the most hopeless place in Santa Monica. Again, another way that Planned Parenthood does it, slick advertising, take the word that's radically opposite to what they stand for, the good word, the good idea, and put it on themselves as if that's what they're truly for, when it's the opposite. I walked into the clinic. I walked up to the check-in counter. I said, can I talk to somebody? And the Planned Parenthood staffer said, yeah, what's going on? And I said, well, you know, I'm pregnant. And she said, well, fill out this paperwork. And I said, well, you know, but I'm 15. And that must have triggered something in her because she said, oh, okay. And she took me behind the check-in counter and she said, okay, what's really going on? And I said, well, you know, I'm 15, I'm pregnant. And she said, and? And I said, well, you know, he's a lot older. You know, he's 23. And the Planned Parenthood worker laughed and she said, okay, you know, just figure out a birth date that works. Lie in the paperwork, say that you're older than you really are. Nobody needs to know about this abortion and he can pay for it and we won't tell anyone. We'll take care of it. Just figure out a birth date that works. We won't tell anyone. Nobody needs to know. My first piece of advice in a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic, posing as a very vulnerable 15-year-old in a situation of statutory rape, which is mandated for them to report it immediately. After that clinic, I left the clinic and I was just thinking, okay, you know, how many times do girls are actually going in there and told that very thing? And I wondered, is this happening at all the clinics? And so that same day, I went into a second clinic, which is a big surgical abortion clinic in the downtown LA area. And what I'm about to share with you, I share this with you because it shows the thinking behind and some of the counseling that goes on at Planned Parenthood. Because at this clinic, I sat down with the manager of the clinic. She took me on as a special case and took me to one of the counseling rooms. I told her my predicament. I'm 15. He's 23. I'm pregnant. And she gave me some advice. She personally counseled me. And the things that she told me, what she told me, I've heard in other clinics. Our investigators have heard similar lines in other clinics. It's perhaps a tactic that they use. But she said to me very compassionately, she said to me, you know, honey, when I was 16, I got pregnant. And I said, really? Well, you know, what did you do? And she said, well, I was very, you know, I was very young. I was still in school, you know, and everything. But you know what? I had my baby. And I remember thinking, She had her baby. And I thought, you know, oh my gosh, maybe she's undercover too. She's a pro-life counselor, you know, have babies at Planned Parenthood. And that's why we're in this little room and I'm undercover. And who's going to say they're undercover first? You know, this is great. So I tried not to smile or anything. And I was like, hey, you know, I said, you had your baby? And she said, yes. But if I could do it again, I would do it very differently. If I could do it again, I would not continue the pregnancy. And my son, you know, he's 17 now. But you know, kids cost a lot. It took me a long time to get through school. He's still living at home. If she could do it again, she would go back in time, she was telling me, and abort her now 17-year-old son. And so therefore, why should I even think about bringing the baby in my womb that I said I had to term? Stepping back from that after leaving that clinic, you know, we were, with me and some friends, we were like, we got to get this in front of people. This is important for people to see. So we put the videos up on YouTube. And, you know, the first day in my dorm room, I was clicking refresh, refresh on the YouTube page to see how many views the video had. And, you know, the first day it had about 100 views. And that was maybe 50 from me and 50 from my mom in San Jose. I was like, this is okay. Or I was like, you know, maybe tomorrow it'll do better. You know, we started like trying to, we sent it to the Fox News affiliate and the, you know, the ABC affiliate. And we tried to shoot it around to different media. We tried to send it to blogs. We wanted to get people to see it. And then the next day it was at 1,000 views. And a few days later it was at 20,000 views. And I was so excited. And me and some friends, we were saying, you know, this is awesome. This is reaching people. We're making an impact. People were starting to talk about it at UCLA. We're like, this is great. Planned Parenthood is getting exposed. And then about day six, I got an email in my dorm room again, sitting at my desk. I spent a lot of time there, you know, working on stuff. And it was from Planned Parenthood. And it said, "Dear Miss Rose, we've recently become aware at Planned Parenthood of Los Angeles of the videos that you've posted on YouTube.com. They violated the privacy of our employees. If you don't immediately take them down, we will sue you for $5,000 for each offense and pursue a full range of civil and legal penalties against you. Sincerely, Planned Parenthood of Los Angeles." And I remember thinking, well, first of all, I don't think I have $200 in my bank account, and I'm going to have a student loan next year, so, you know, come and get me. But no, I was taken aback. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a lawyer. I certainly didn't have a PR team or, you know, the number for Bill O'Reilly's producer. I didn't know what to do. So I just turned to God, and I just said, okay, God, you know, this is whatever you want. Whatever you want. Your will be done. And I said, I trust you. And God, of course, there's no one more trustworthy. God is the trustworthy one who works all things for the good of those that love him. Romans 8:28. And truly he will take our little attempts to do something for him and he will transform them into his work. All we have to do is reach out to him and say, Father, your will be done. Help me. I trust you. And he will transform anything for good in our lives and in the lives of those around us and for our country. So great is his power, so great is his love. And within 24 hours after, you know, calling up, you know, Alliance Defense Fund, which I had heard about, they could help students and, you know, talking to different people, I got a lawyer to represent me, but Bill O'Reilly wanted to run the story, and I had my first interview on the O'Reilly Factor, and those videos that Planned Parenthood was trying to silence were aired for millions of people to see. And I learned a big lesson. That truly God uses our attempts again and again, and he will use any trial for good. He will use any trial for good. And I've seen it again and again and again. And there's been a principle that I'm still attempting to learn, which is that when we trust God with something, he will reward us by giving us a bigger challenge. Because he's that awesome. A bigger opportunity to trust him. That's his love. Because he wants us to seek out intimacy with his salvific work for the rest of the world, intimacy with his loving, merciful heart. And then we have to say, like Peter, who says, Lord, is that you? And Jesus is walking on the water, and he says, yes, and he says, come. And Peter springs out in his confidence and his love onto the water to go reach out to Christ. And then he gets really scared because it's gonna kind of stormy. And he looks around at the storm, he looks down at the water, and he starts to sink. And he says, Lord, save me. And Jesus, of course, reaches out his hands to save him. And then he says, oh, you of little faith, Why did you doubt? Why did you fear?
And I am like St. Peter all the time, especially in pro-life work, because it's one thing after the next. But God is always asking us when we try to do something for him, he's asking us to trust him. And then when we take a step in confidence and something good happens and then a big trial comes, that's another opportunity to trust him, to see his strength made perfect in our weakness. Because isn't he so good at doing that? I would have never imagined fast forwarding 5 years. Now I'm 24 years old. I've, you know, been out of school for a couple years, and I would have never imagined looking back at, you know, starting Live Action and the journey that I've been on and the journey Live Action has been on and the journey of us, our movement, that the things that I've gotten to be a part of, I would have gotten to be a part of. The things I've been involved in, the work to defund Planned Parenthood, the work to expose the abortion industry, working, being a part of the amazing and growing youth movement all across the country. The last few years, even with the most pro-abortion president in history, we've seen amazing gains in the pro-life movement. Some of the most historic pro-life legislation, some of the most pro-life legislation we've ever seen. We've seen the defunding of Planned Parenthood up to $60 million at the state and local level. Even while the federal level, they have such powerful friends in Washington. And all of this is because of people like here in this room who are willing to not be afraid, who are willing to not back down and not be intimidated and not say, well, this fight is for another time when the political climate is better. This fight is for another time when you know, the indicators look better for us. But instead to stand up now and say, now is the time. Enough is enough now. Now we have to make a change and are willing to make that change. And we are making that change. I want to share just a couple more things about Planned Parenthood. In the last 5 years of research, just a few notes, and many of you are very familiar with this already, and many of you have been involved in this fight long before I've even gotten involved. And I thank you for that. I thank you for inspiring and encouraging my generation. But a few of the things that we have seen in the last 5 years, you know, the abuses and the abuses that accompany that ultimate abuse of abortion and the cover-up of child sexual abuse, you know, after those first investigations in L.A., we took teams. You know, summers became summer project time where I would travel with teams of young people across the country to expose the different sexual abuse cover-ups happening all across the country in state after state. And again, you know, posing as a 13-year-old with a 31-year-old man. Saying Planned Parenthood, you know, what do I do? And then them saying, I didn't hear the age. I don't want to know the age. Saying, you know, we won't tell anyone. He can pay for it. The same line. And then seeing the cover-up not only of sexual abuse but the medical misinformation and the lies. We did a project called the Rosa Acuna Project based off of a young woman who was told that the baby in her womb was not a baby. It's just a blood clot. It's a bunch of cells. And after she had the abortionist left pieces of the baby inside of her. And she went to a hospital hemorrhaging, and she discovered they pulled out a little arm, a little leg. And she learned, of course, that this was a baby. And she launched a lawsuit against the abortionist for malpractice and for the misinformation, the outright medical lies that she had been told that this was somehow not a baby, completely unscientific, as we know, completely a lie. So we did investigations showing Planned Parenthood saying that the heartbeat doesn't start until, you know, until 8 weeks or until 20 weeks or until right before the baby is born, they would tell our investigators. When does the heartbeat start? 3.5 weeks, maybe 21 days. And they were saying outrageous things about the risks of abortion. Oh, there are no risks, about any number of things that was just outright misinformation. We started to investigate the aiding and abetting of sexual trafficking that goes on at these clinics. There are 300,000 sexually trafficked children in our country. Many of them domestic children, junior high girls, high school girls who are drafted in from high school or junior high parking lots, taken to, you know, motels or trailer parks and sold by traffickers. They get involved in drugs. They get them usually hooked on drugs, and they're abused. And the best friend of a sexual trafficker in our country is going to be the reproductive health clinic that has a sick code of confidentiality and has a don't ask, don't tell policy about anything that even apparently might even come close to resembling sexual abuse. And that, of course, is Planned Parenthood in our country, who does not see a suffering, vulnerable young girl as someone who deserves our help and with someone with dignity, but instead as another abortion number that they can add to their growing numbers every year. And they have grown their abortion numbers every year for the past few years. They are growing their share on the abortion market.
As the industry abortion leader, they commit over a fourth of all abortions in our country every year. They're a $1 billion industry. They get a half of their over $1 billion budget from the government, from us, from taxpayers. And with the sequester going on right now and all of the talk back and forth about what's going to get cut and the cuts to our military and the cuts to, you know, even some of the environmentalists are mad, the cuts to some of those programs, there are no cuts to Planned Parenthood, even while most Americans identify as being pro-life. And even more Americans than that don't want a single dollar of their tax money, their hard-earned dollars, going to the biggest abortion chain in our country. And yet the arrogance and the radicalism of our current administration to push this down the throats again and again of the American people. All of these different abuses, we also investigated just last year the sex selective abortion that's happening at Planned Parenthood and across the country. I mean, many of you may have heard about this concept of this war on baby girls. And I want to share a few minutes of one of our videos with you. The gender side, I mean, it's happening in India and it's happening in China where they say there's over 100 million missing girls. Some estimate more than that, 200 million. But girls that have been killed just because they're girls. And some of the original sex selection abortion technology was exported to India to be experimented with. This was about 50 years ago or so, by some of the same Planned Parenthood Federation board members that were also advocating for legalized abortion in the United States. It's all interconnected because they see, again, killing the girl in the womb as a key way to control populations. And that, too, is part of the founding of Planned Parenthood, as many of you may already know, with Margaret Sanger. In the 1930s, the self-proclaimed eugenicist who thought that she could use sterilization, sometimes forced sterilization, and later on abortion, to control and to limit populations that she thought shouldn't exist. And those include those with disabilities and minority populations, especially the black population in America, targeting these populations with carefully placed abortion, sterilization, contraceptive health centers, to create her perfect race. And this was the same thinking was happening across the ocean over in Germany. And she was pen pals with some of the eugenicists who were creating and crafting the final solutions, the final solution for the Jewish population in Hitler's Germany. And we know what happened there, the incredible Holocaust and genocide that happened there. But here, the genocide and the Holocaust was being planned by the architects at Planned Parenthood, by Margaret Sanger. And so the sex selective abortion investigation was to show that some of those, the cultural impetus to say, well, maybe I want a boy more than a girl, because some cultures, maybe in India or China, especially in China with the one child policy, if you can only have one child, well, we want a boy. He'll provide for the family. He'll carry on the family name. And so rampant in China is the brutal killing of little girls just because they're girls. And part of that is the forced one child policy. But this investigation, has any of you seen any of these videos from the sex selective abortion investigation? Just a few of us. This is just, I find this some of the most compelling evidence, in part because of the hypocrisy that it demonstrates, that it underlines with a bright red marker, that Planned Parenthood, while claiming to be pro-women and while crying about a war on women last year, remember that? The war on women that those crazy conservatives are waging because they hate women. Of course, I hate women. Look at me. I can't stand them. I mean, obviously, we are not the war on women. The real war on women is happening when women are lied to, abused, even killed at Planned Parenthood clinics, at abortion clinics, and their children, many times their little girls, are being killed too. We know that that's the real war on women. But this video shows this Planned Parenthood worker collaborating with our investigator for the late-term abortion of a little girl just because she's a girl. And we can show this video now. This was part of a five-part series that documented the same kind of activity at five different states, five different videos showing the same thing. And Planned Parenthood responded, as they typically respond, by firing the first employee, which we call throw the employee under the bus to try to make it go away. And then Live Action, as is typical with our other projects, we come out with a second video, and then Planned Parenthood says we're doctoring our tapes. And then, of course, we release the full footage so you can see the full thing about what's going on. And then Planned Parenthood says, well, we're going to retrain our staff.
And they've retrained their staff quite a few times, and we're pretty clear for us that they're retraining their staff to learn how to detect our cameras, and clearly allowing their staff to continue their ideology and their mission, which is not to protect the dignity of the woman or to protect, of course, that child, but instead to force this ideology that, first of all, life is not precious and life is disposable, but also that a woman, that what is empowering for a woman is not to give a child and tell the man, whoever, you know, may have gotten her pregnant or maybe pressuring her, I'm not going to kill my baby for anyone, but instead to tell that man, to tell that woman to make her submit to the societal pressures and the fears and the weight that's on her to make a decision that's going to hurt her the rest of her life. And that's the truth about what they're doing every day. I want to tell one more story from abortion clinic, you know, experiences. I was in another clinic. I was posing as the abuse victim in this clinic, and I'll never forget this. It remains in my heart. And I was sitting in the waiting room. There were two waiting rooms. One of them was for women without children, and one of them was for women with children. And this was abortion day at this big surgical clinic, and the abortion room for women without children was full. There were maybe 30 women in there. And there's a sign on the door that says, you know, no children, no cell phones, no bags. And in my waiting room, it was just me and my investigative partner, Jackie, one of my dear friends from high school. And we're sitting there, you know, posing as, you know, 13-year-old, 14-year-olds waiting for our appointment. And we weren't alone in that room. Two women came in a few minutes later. And they looked to be sisters, and they had these two beautiful little girls with them, maybe 5 and 7 years old. And the little girls, you know, ran over to a pile of brightly colored toys that Planned Parenthood had for the women with children in this waiting room, and they started playing with the toys, and the two women sit down. And I look over at one of the women, and I realize that she must be pregnant. She's beginning just to show. I thought I could see that she was pregnant. And so I turned to her and I thought maybe there's something I could say to her. Maybe there's a way to get her to leave. Even though I'm here undercover doing this project, maybe I can get her to leave. Because I knew that, you know, I might be in the room with a baby who was at risk. And so I turned to this woman and I said, you know, what are you here for? And she said, abortion. And I said, well, you know, why don't we both just get out of here? Why don't we both just go with the people that were outside and go to that other place, that other clinic? Because when we had walked into the clinic, there had been sidewalk counselors with open arms saying, we're here to help you. This is not good for you. This is not good for your baby. This is not that you're going to regret this. We're here to help you. Free confidential services. Come with us to the pregnancy center down the street. And so I said to this woman, why don't we both just get out of here? And the woman looked at me and she said, stop talking to me. And she looked at the ground. Suddenly, this little five-year-old girl, this beautiful little girl, she jumps up. She's bored playing with her toys. And she goes over to the woman reading a magazine who was her mother. She was saying, Mama, Mama. And her mom's kind of ignoring her. She's just reading the magazine. And then she moves over to the other woman who was looking at the ground, who was there for the abortion. And she's calling her auntie. She's saying, Auntie, Auntie. She's pulling on her pant leg. Her aunt's looking very upset. She's looking at the ground. And then she jumps up onto her aunt's lap. And this little beautiful girl snuggles close to her aunt's abdomen, close to her stomach. And as I looked, I realized that I was looking at the meeting of two cousins, separated by just inches of flesh. And that on that day in that clinic, one of those little cousins was scheduled to be killed, and that little girl would never get to know her cousin, a little boy or a little girl, never get to play with him, never get to know him. I'll never forget that because it reminds me that this is something that is intimate to each one of us, whether we like it or not. But because we are missing little cousins sometimes, or even brothers or sisters, sons or daughters, grandchildren, people in our extended family, would-be classmates, would-be people in our churches, would-be people at our schools, we're missing people all over our country, and some of them so close to us, we might not even know some of the people that we're missing. And whether we like it or not, this great injustice, this destroyer of peace, is intimate and affects, it's personal and affects each one of us. It tears at the very heart of the most intimate human relationships. Within just a few minutes, the woman was called and she walked through the door and I never saw her again. I went to my appointment shortly after that.
And I'll never know what she ended up doing, what ended up happening to that baby. But every day there's countless situations just like that one. I was in an abortion clinic last Saturday just to do some sidewalk counseling, not for an investigation. And I was sitting, I found myself in the waiting room, actually. I kind of snuck in there just hang out and talk to women. They didn't notice, believe it or not. And you can do it. It's amazing how much they don't notice sometimes. I was just chatting with people, and I was sitting across from a man who was there waiting for his wife, who was in for an abortion appointment, with their maybe 12-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter. And I wondered, this was a low-income part of, outside in Virginia, and I wondered, what memories will these children have of the day that their parents brought third child to be killed at this abortion clinic? We're living in a society, in a culture that is so wounded by this greatest of injustices. And the responsibility that is on our shoulders is a great one. But it is also a beautiful opportunity. And this is what gives me such a source of great joy every day when I get to go to work for hopefully in some way build the culture of life, do some work to end this great injustice, to end abortion. St. Augustine says that people travel the world to marvel at the height of mountains, at the vast course of rivers, at the circular motion of the stars, at the huge, strong oceans, but that people pass by themselves without wondering. And St. Augustine is saying, of course, how wonderful is the human person, made in the image and likeness of God. How beautiful, how marvelous is the human person, the greatest of all of God's creations. How beautiful. Each one of us, the life that we've been given, made in the image of a most loving God himself, made for love, made to love and to be loved. And how beautiful each little child in total vulnerability as a single cell embryo, the moment of conception when angels may be singing and when God delights in loving that child into existence to be a gift to the world, to be part of his glory. How beautiful is the human person. And what a gift we have, as well as this responsibility, to be a part of this movement, this growing movement, to stand up and say, we will do whatever it takes to restore this nation to the fidelity, to the most fundamental right to life, and this great idea that we are made in the image and likeness of God, and that we are endowed by our Creator, as our Declaration says, with certain inalienable rights, and among these are the right to life, and life comes first. It must come first. What a gift to be a part of all of this. I know I said it a little earlier, but the people in this room and so many of you here who have been laboring in this great field for so many years, who have been sidewalk counseling or working at pregnancy care centers or working, in politics or working at Cleveland Right to Life and any number of programs, working with young people, thank you for your diligence. Thank you for not giving up, even when it may have gotten discouraging. Or tiresome after year of legal abortion continues in our nation and the woundedness continues. Thank you for staying the course. Because I do believe that because of the paths that you have forged and my generation standing on your shoulders, I do believe with my whole heart that we will see a day in this great country when abortion is as unthinkable as it once was. And when there is no more legal abortion, and when our society protects every life. And I, like many other young people, am dedicated to doing whatever part I may be able to play in this great movement to do what I can do to build this culture of life and to restore our nation. And I believe with my whole heart we're going to get there if we do not give up, if we continue to fight. Because you know what? This, in the end, is God's fight. And we are just a part. We are allowed to be a part of this fight, to be a part of this work with him. And he is the strongest one in the room. He is the king, and he is all powerful. And he can move a mountain, but he asks for a mustard seed of faith from us. He asks for us to give our reach out, give a little bit of ourselves and say, okay, God, here I am. Use me. Show me what I can do for you. And how much he will use us in the great forcefulness and yet the great respect of his love, the great respecter of human freedoms, but also the great lover of each human to say, yes, I want to take your little bit of willingness and I'll turn it into beautiful things. And so let's all continue to dedicate ourselves and not give up and not grow weary. And I'll close with the words of St. Paul in Ephesians. Do not be weary of doing the good work. For in due season, you will reap the reward if you do not give up. And we will never give up. We will finish this job. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Lila Rose, everyone. Lila Rose. Thank you. No. We have a, I'm sorry. No. I just want you to enjoy your ovation for a while. We are just so proud of you. We stand with you and the work that you're doing on our behalf in Washington, D.C. and around the world. But yes, there are a few questions. You sparked a lot of questions, and I'm only able to ask two of them. But I'm going to blend some of them together. And remember what I told you earlier, those of you that have been here all day, that all the questions will be answered on Molly's radio program on page 24 in your program. You will see the details about the radio program, and you'll be able to hear all of the answers. Some of them I want to blend together, but this one in particular, Lila, since the last election when so many of us were so upset by the outcome, you have stayed positive and focused on Twitter while some have become negative. This is just a thank you for your strength and example to all of us, which leads to the question that came in first, which is, does your courage come naturally? That's what Natalie wants to know.
Well, first of all, you know, courage is acting out what's in the heart. And if we try, and for me, when I try to stay close to God, and I'm a Christian, you know, every bit of my strength comes from God. It truly does. And when we're close to God in prayer and we take the time to get to know him and be intimate with him, then he will just amaze us by the graces that he'll give us to do whatever he wants us to do. So I certainly could not have accomplished any of this. You know, it is truly through God who strengthens us. And if we're willing to put our neck out there a little bit, he will reward us with every grace and with every help. And, you know, I think it would be, in a sense, more courageous if I didn't do anything. Because now that I've seen, now that I've encountered this great evil, I can't help but do something. And I know many of you feel the same, because it would just hurt me, you know, too much to know that I was doing nothing. And I think that, you know, we feel the same, and God will certainly give us every courage along the way to do whatever if we just put ourselves out there a little bit and say, okay, God, here I am.
But you certainly want to keep her in your prayers. I mean, D.C. is a very dark place for this message. All right. Does Planned Parenthood make any money from the Postal Board of Human Remains? Have your investigations resulted in any criminal prosecutions? Could you get these videos on the congressional hearing floor and on and on and on? But if you can wrap up maybe in one answer those three.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, first of all, yes, there's a whole industry around the trafficking of fetal parts. That's a story for another day, but it's absolutely true. There have been prosecutions as a result of Live Action's work. Clinics have been closed, put on probation. You know, individuals have been prosecuted. There's ongoing investigations right now because of our sex selective investigation. So there is a lot of that concrete evidence and results. And then, of course, the defunding efforts, which we're so happy about. And, you know, a little bit of truth goes a long way. It really does, even in Washington, although sometimes it needs to be accompanied by a loud media outcry to get them to move. But, you know, a little bit of truth goes a long way on social media networks. You know, the power of visual media is amazing. That's why we do undercover journalism. And so I just, you know, I invite you to all continue your work with the Right to Life, continue your work here in Ohio, continue the fight, get involved with us online at Live Action on our Facebook page, our Twitter, our Twitter feeds and everything else, and keep sharing the evidence. Keep talking about it, because the truth in the end is what's going to win this thing. The truth united with our willingness to love and to be compassionate, but to still be bold and strong in speaking what is true, because that's going to in the end get our nation back to protecting every life. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lila. Thank you so much. What an encouragement. What an inspiration. And a year or so ago when she told me she moved to Washington full time, I said, yes, what an inspiration, what encouragement. And for those of you that are not familiar, that Live Action actually accepts financial donations to keep that work alive. So for those of you that have an abundance, you might want to talk to Lila or get some more information from Bringing America Back to Life Symposium coordinators, and they will be able to help you know more about that. In the meantime, I also wanted to recognize again and thank The Answer for the music that they brought into this dinner.
You have been listening to Lila Rose, President and Founder of Live Action, and 2013 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker.